Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
If you're wondering why I'm still dressed up, normally I'm not dressed up on Sunday. I haven't been home. So I'm wearing what I was wearing this morning. Somebody at the chorus concert said, "Wow, you're really dressed up." And I said, "These are my work clothes." Anyway, hope you're doing well. I hope I don't fall asleep. I'm really tired. But for those of you that don't know, I video and photograph all the fine art stuff for Lipscomb. And they had their final chorus concert today in Acuff Chapel. And the place that I record in Acuff Chapel is a quote, a balcony. There's no seats up there. But the only way you can get to this balcony is through a steel ladder that's connected to the wall. And my backpack that has all my equipment in it weighs about 50 pounds. So I've been up and down that ladder more times than I want to think about today, and I'm kind of tired. So we'll see if that affects my energy level tonight. Hopefully not. But as we continue in week two of our new series on the Herods that are referenced in Scripture. And I'm not going to revisit everything we talked about last week. Last week we spent the whole time doing kind of an introduction to the first in the line of the Herods, known as Herod the Great. But I will revisit a couple things just to set the context. You know, the name Herod, we talked about this last week, appears numerous times in the New Testament, specifically in the Gospels and in the book of Acts, Acts of Apostles. And this time period that are covered by the mention of these Herods is at least 50 years, might even say probably longer, all the way from Matthew 2 that we looked at last week through Acts 26, King Herod Agrippa II. So from Herod the Great to King Herod Agrippa II. And so trying to emphasize, these are not all the same men, but they're all part of the same family. And they can be thought of as a dynasty, a ruling dynasty in Judea, if you will, okay? And their references in Scripture give us an opportunity to understand more about the political climate that was going on during the time of when Jesus was here on this earth, during the time of the first disciples who were taking the gospel out into the world. You know, we cover, again, at least a 50-year period of time. So it gives us an opportunity to set some additional context for Scripture. Now, this is the family tree, if you will, that we looked at last week. Beginning with Herod the Great, what this doesn't have on it is Herod the Great's father, Antipater. And something that I failed to mention last week, it was on the slide, Donnie caught it, it was on the slide, but I didn't mention it, that I do want to mention tonight is that I talked about how Antipater, who was Herod the Great's father, who was by ethnic origin was an Idumean, an Edomite, okay? But by faith, if you will, he was a Jew. A Jew because, and I just went totally blank, it'll come to me in a minute. There's another group that I'm losing. But what'd you say?
Hasmonean.
Hasmoneans, yeah, sorry, thank you. I was like, it's just not that, see, I'm tired. It's just not it was not the file cabinet wouldn't open. It's like the Hasmoneans. So the Hasmoneans who conquered who came out of the Maccabean revolt against the Greeks, we'll just summarize it that way. Again, as I said last week, I'm providing very superficial detail here. This don't mistake this for a detailed world history class, okay? But coming out of the Maccabeans' revolt against the Greeks, you have the Hasmoneans, who were an independent ruling group during the second to the first century BC, okay, up until the time of Herod the Great. And Herod the Great's father, Antipater, was high up among the Hasmoneans because he had married into that family, okay? He had married into that dynasty, the Hasmonean dynasty, okay? And Anyway, so that's the first two pieces, their ethnic origin, the fact that they identify themselves as Jews by faith. Doesn't mean they practiced, but by faith. But then how did that relationship begin with the Romans? Because Herod the Great was a ruler for the Roman Empire. How'd that begin? Well, that began because Antipater, I'm about to have another moment. Antipater supported Roman general, prior to Mark Antony. It begins with a P. Pompey, there you go. The general Pompey, the Roman general Pompey. I was thinking not the city, but the general, but I couldn't come up with the name, Pompey. So the general Pompey, whew, it's going to be a long night, fellas, because it's all in here. I don't have anything to read off to you, okay? So if it's not coming out, it's going to be tough. Woo! It's one of those moments. Let me actually write out my stuff. Ooh, you don't want that. You don't want me to read stuff to you. But Antipater supported the general Pompey in his campaign against Judea. Now, he was a Roman general. And that led to, again, I'm cutting some corners here, that led to Julius Caesar, we know him, right? Giving Antipater an appointment within the Roman Empire in Judea, okay? What I didn't mention last week was when that happened, Julius Caesar made Antipater a Roman citizen. And that Roman citizenship carried throughout his lineage. So all of these that followed in, that followed Antipater, who I'm drawing up here, there's nothing up here, but Antipater was the father of Herod the Great. All of these were Roman citizens. So again, Idumean by ethnic origin, Jewish by faith, because they were a part of the Hasmonean dynasty under that control originally, but Roman citizens because their father was made a Roman citizen by Julius Caesar. So I didn't want to leave that out. I did leave it out last week, but I wanted to mention it today. So this is what we're not going to look at every single box on here. And as I mentioned last week, this is only part of the family tree of Herod the Great because Herod the Great had 10 wives. But of the ones of the ancestors that are mentioned in Scripture, we only need to cover 5 of them, okay? 5 of the 10 wives. And so you will see some names that you may recognize from Scripture, like Herod Antipas or Philip II or Herod Philip. Or moving down, Herod Agrippa from Acts chapter 12, or Herod Agrippa II from Acts chapters 25 and 26. So we're going to be covering from Herod the Great to Herod Agrippa II. And last week, we spent the whole time, other than this little introduction, talking about Herod the Great. So I'm not going to revisit everything in Herod the Great. But let's just cut to the chase. He ruled, this is an image of a bust of him, whether this is what he actually looked like or not, we will never know, at least on this side of eternity. But he lived from 73 BC to 4 BC. He reigned as the king of Judea from approximately 37 BC to 4 BC. I say approximately because different sources will have either 36 or 37. It depends on... He began his campaign against the Hasmonean king in 39. Some say he was victorious by 37, others say he was victorious by 36, but we're talking about a year difference, okay? And we're talking about 2,000 years ago. So it's within that time frame that he became the Roman Senate-appointed king of Judea. And as we read from Matthew chapter 2 last week, we won't do that again this week, when the wise men come, and they encounter Herod the Great, who are they looking for? The king of the Jews, right? And Herod's thinking, that's me, right? That's me, but they're not looking for him. And by the latter part of Herod's reign, again, 37 to 4, by the latter part of his reign, by most accounts, Herod was becoming so paranoid that he was going to lose his throne that he was kind of a madman. We talked about last week, he had some of his own children killed because he thought they were going to take the throne. He had his second wife killed because he was paranoid that she was committing adultery, even though he had married her for political convenience. He was not a great man. And the big takeaway was he was called Herod the Great, not because he was a great man, but really for two reasons. One, he was a great builder. You might even think of like a designer, a conceptualizer. Okay, he wasn't actually out there hammering on the rocks, but he put together these incredible projects throughout modern day Israel that they're still there. I mean, the archaeological excavations are still there today. This great builder of things throughout Israel. And also during his reign, the people of Israel enjoyed a relative period of prosperity. As I said last week, it's easy to be happy with your rulers when things are going well, right? Absence of war, things are going well, people are prosperous, even under the hands of the Romans. Not so much with some of his sons, though. Okay, we'll talk about that as we go further down the road. But that's Herod the Great. Great because he was a great builder, not because he was a great man. He was a horrible man. Even more so than just Matthew 2, where he had all the babies in Jerusalem killed. From what we talked about last week, I think you would agree, we talked about some of the things that he did in addition to the Matthew 2 passage. And I think you would agree that what he did in Matthew 2 is consistent with what you see in the rest of his life. Again, having his own children killed. So much so that Octavian said about him, it is better to be his dog than to be one of his children. Okay? That's not a good thing to say about a father, right? So he was not a great man. And is the last thing I'll give you about Herod the Great before we talk about where we're going to go from here is we're going to start talking about some of these building projects, because as I just said, his fingerprints, even today, 2,000 years later, are all over Israel, which means during the life of Jesus and during the life of his disciples, his fingerprints were all over Israel. Okay? More than just him being the ruler up until, you know, the early years of Jesus' life, much of what he built would have been very visible to those who were, you know, again, Jesus here on this earth and his disciples, okay? Most of what we know about Herod the Great comes from the Jewish/Roman, he was a Jew writing for the Romans, historian Flavius Josephus, two books, Antiquities of the Jews, Wars of the Jews. I remember that tonight. I forgot that last week. Antiquities of the Jews, Wars of the Jews. Fascinating read. I don't suggest sitting down and trying to read it straight through, but as a reference book, you can find it out there online. It's the copyright has long since expired on a first century writing. Okay, he had a lot of material that he wrote about his people, the Jewish people, up through the time of his life, which included the time of Herod the Great. And so he had a lot to say about Herod the Great. Now, during the peak of Herod's rule, okay, Herod the Great, or sometimes thought of as Herod the First, because he had a number of sons, grandsons, great-grandsons who also had the name or the title Herod. But his empire was these bold lines that are here on the outside. And so while he was referred to as the king of Judea, it actually went, if you think of Judea as just the southern part of Israel, he really was the king of all of what we would call today Palestine. Okay, that was his territory. The reason why this map has a bunch of different colors on it is to designate how his kingdom, okay, was divided up after his death among his children. Okay, none of his children inherited or became his successor in terms of the entire pie. They all got pieces. And that's why, again, you read about, you know, John the Baptist telling Herod that he shouldn't have his brother Philip's wife. Well, why are they both in play here? Because they're both tetrarchs. They're both in charge of smaller pieces of what their father, Herod the Great, was the king of. Okay? Everybody with me so far? Okay. So, that's the kingdom. So, let's talk about the building projects. The rest of what we're going to talk about with Herod the Great is I want to look at four building projects that Herod undertook while he was king of Judea, okay? These four I will present in chronological order, of when they were completed. They will be, first, tonight, we're going to look at Masada, okay? On Masada, we'll explain this in a minute, Masada, which is a a tall mesa right beside the Dead Sea, Herod built two palaces. This was the first major project that he completed. Okay. Next, we will look at another place where he built a palace and a fortress called Herodium. Herodium, which was a man-made mountain. When you see it, if you haven't seen it before, some of you have seen some of these slides before because I did this 4 years ago. I did a whole series on the Holy Land, but Herodium is a man-made mountain, and that mountain is still standing today. And bits of the palace are still up on top, and is most likely where Herod was buried. I say most likely because they haven't found the body. He's 2,000 years old. But Josephus is the one that said that Herod was buried when he died. He died in Jericho in 4 BC, but that his body was taken and buried in Herodium, and they have found a large tomb at Herodium that they believe was Herod the Great's. Okay, so that's the second thing we'll look at. The third thing that we will look at is Caesarea Maritima. It is not referred to Caesarea Maritima in Scripture. It is just referred to as Caesarea. The name Maritima is added often to distinguish it from Caesarea Philippi, which are two very different places, both in Scripture. But Caesarea Maritima, again, in Scripture, just Caesarea. You read about that numerous times in the book of Acts, only in the book of Acts. And the reason why you only read about it in the book of Acts is because it wasn't really a thing until kind of the beginning of Jesus' life, okay? And so what Caesarea Maritima was the magnificent port for Israel for the Roman Empire. Prior to Caesarea being built by Herod to be this showplace of a port city, the port for Israel was Joppa. Israel does not have a natural port. If you go along the Mediterranean Sea, there is not a natural harbor, not a place where you go, hey, there's a perfect bay here to build a port. It doesn't have one. So Herod dug one out and built one on the Mediterranean. And so we'll talk about that. And then the final thing we will look at is Herod building the Temple Mount and rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem, which was the last major project he completed before his death. Okay, fair enough? All right, so the first thing we're going to look at is Masada. Now, this is a modern map of Israel, okay? It's a modern map of Israel. So if you're like, hey, I don't see any of the Bible names on there, well, there's not many, but there's a few. But this is a modern map of Israel. Modern Israel's in the news a lot. Paying attention, it's in the news a lot, okay? So I want to give you just a sense of geography of some of the places we're going to talk about and where they are. So I don't expect you to be able to read much of what's on there. That's not the point of me putting this map up there. As I say often, I can barely read it from here. That's okay. I want you to get a sense of the land, okay? I want you to get a sense of the land. So Jerusalem is right here, okay? This is the city of Jerusalem, still called Jerusalem today, as it was back in the time of Jesus. North of Jerusalem, in generally this area, you can see, maybe you can read Nazareth there, but there's Nazareth. This area up including this little lake right here, this is Galilee, okay? That is the northern part of Israel. Remember, Herod the Great was appointed governor of Galilee before he was made king of Judea. His father, Antipater, is the one that named him to be governor of Galilee, okay? This is Galilee up here. To the east and the south of Jerusalem, you have Judea, and you have the Judean wilderness. We'll talk about the Judean wilderness when we talk about Masada. You have the Judean wilderness. You hear about the West Bank a lot in the news. This is the West Bank. Jerusalem is just outside the West Bank. Bethlehem is just inside the West Bank. Masada, that we're going to talk about in just a minute, is inside the West Bank. The West Bank is technically owned by Israel, but it is considered to be Palestinian control, which means you have to go in a checkpoint both directions. Okay? The checkpoint going from the West Bank to Israel is way more difficult than the checkpoint going from Israel to the West Bank. Okay? Because there is no centralized government in the West Bank. You can tell that as soon as you cross the border when you start seeing trash all over the place. There's no centralized service to pick up the trash. There's no centralized stuff that we take for granted here, like fire departments and hospitals and all that stuff, that just doesn't exist in the West Bank because there's no centralized government. Okay, just again, trying to show how modern Israel fits in with ancient Israel. Okay, so Masada that we're going to talk about is today inside the West Bank. Now, here we have the Mediterranean. There's Gaza that is in, you know, has been in the news for the last, 3 years? And modern-day Gaza is in the same location as where the ancient city of Gaza was, one of the Philistine strongholds. Everything south of this town here called Beersheba, which was the southern border of Israel. You read in Scripture numerous times from Dan to Beersheba. Beersheba was like the southern border of the nation of Israel. Everything down here is desert. Okay, it is a wasteland. It is desert. Galilee, especially in the rainy months, green, hilly, beautiful. Everything down here, nothing. Just desert. So if you have in your head everything in Israel is a desert, it's not true, but everything down here is a desert. Okay, it's all desert. Okay. Now, Masada. So we have here the Sea of Galilee. This lake that I mentioned here is the Sea of Galilee. To the south, you have the Dead Sea. And in between, connecting, you have the Jordan River. Okay. Masada is just to the west of the Dead Sea. Okay. The Dead Sea, which is the lowest place on planet Earth. Okay. At least that's above ground. I mean, above water. Okay. It is the lowest place on planet Earth. And moving in a little closer to the Dead Sea, you can see here the Dead Sea, and to the west of the Dead Sea, you have Masada. Okay? Here, again, thinking about some of those landmarks we just looked at, there's Jerusalem, there is Bethlehem, Hebron. In Gedi, which is a place where David escaped from Saul, through the mountains of En Gedi, and then down here is Masada. Okay, so what happened at Masada? Masada is technically, it is a mesa. Okay, what is a mesa? It's like a mountain with a flat top. You with me? Okay, so normal mountain kind of comes up to a point. A mesa, flat top. Okay, it's flat on top. The mesa is 1,500 feet tall, but because of where it's located, that 1,500 feet is barely above sea level. Okay, again, lowest place on planet Earth. It's barely above sea level. Masada is a place that the name literally means fortress, and it is the location where Herod built two palaces. Today, named the Northern Palace and the Southern Palace. Okay, almost all the remains that we have are from the Northern Palace. Almost nothing is left from the Southern Palace. Okay, so everything I'm going to show you is from the Northern Palace. Everything we know about Masada comes from the same source for everything we know about Herod the Great, and that is Flavius Josephus. Everything we know about Masada comes from Flavius Josephus and archaeology. Okay, the other piece we have is we have archaeology because there are remains of that northern palace that Herod the Great built. Okay, Masada. Masada is not mentioned in Scripture, so this is not you might not call this technically a Bible place, other than this individual who was king of Judea when Jesus was born. This was where one of, or two of, his palaces were located. And it also gives you a sense of the power that he had, that he was able to have a group of people that could build something like this. How much authority he had, how much backing he had from the Roman Empire. Remember, when he was named as king of Judea in 39 BC, there was already a king of Judea, a Hasmonean. But the Roman Senate gave him an army to go and take Judea. So he had the backing of Rome. And you can see in what he built how much power he had. Okay? And so one of the reasons why we look at Masada, not because it's in Scripture, because it's not, but because you get a sense of, again, the authority that this man had, okay? And Herod is in Scripture, okay? And when you think about that, you know, Jesus was told, or his parents were told, to flee to Egypt until this man dies. That what a threat he was because he had so much power, okay? Now, this place, though, As we think about the family tree of Herod, was essentially abandoned after Herod died. I don't know why, but his sons largely abandoned this place. They didn't take possession of it after he died. And so, you know, we'll talk a little bit about this. This is not really central to the story of what happened at Masada, but different groups occupied Masada over the centuries. The first of which were Jews. Jewish rebels known as the Sicarii. Okay, that sounds to me like a Marvel villain, but that was what they were called, the Sicarii. And they were known as the Sicarii because of what they carried. They carried these curved knives like scimitars. Now, what's the context of these Jewish rebels? Well, to understand that, we have to go back. Masada was built in the very beginning of Herod's reign. So he began reign 37 BC. He almost immediately began working on Masada. We are now, what Masada is most known for, though, happens not in 1st century BC, but in 1st century AD. Okay? In 1st century AD, in 66 AD, this is well after the death of Jesus, but there was a revolt, a Jewish revolt, considered by some, referred to by some as the first great Jewish revolt, against the Roman Empire that began in 66 AD. That revolt began in Caesarea Maritima. Okay? Maybe you might say the pinnacle of that revolt, or what is most remembered from that revolt, is the destruction of Jerusalem that occurred in AD 70. Now, that is biblical, because Jesus in Matthew 24 said, there's not going to be one rock left upon the other, right? What's he talking about? He's talking about, it's not going to be very long before all of this is going to be flattened. Okay, we'll talk about that when we talk about the Temple Mount. But Jesus said that was going to happen. Well, that was part of this Jewish-Roman war that began in 66 AD. 70 AD, Jerusalem fell and was burned to the ground. The last stronghold of the Jewish rebels was at Masada. This is after Herod the Great is dead. His sons, his grandchildren have abandoned Masada. The Sicarii, who are the last rebels, make their final stand at Masada. Okay, everybody with me so far? They make their final stand at Masada. By the way, this has nothing to do with Masada. Well, it has something to do with Masada. This great Jewish revolt, in case you hadn't already figured it out, the Romans thwarted the revolt. Okay. Ultimately, all the Sicarii on top of Masada died. Okay, we'll talk about that as we go through this. They all died. The revolt was thwarted. It took several years, but it was thwarted. Having visited Israel twice, I have been fully versed from the guides that we have been with about the Jewish viewpoint of the Jewish revolt against the Romans. What I really didn't expect, though, was this past summer when we visited Rome, was to see in Rome, they have these arches, kind of like they have in Paris, but these arches that are all built to memorialize something. And I noticed on this one arch that on the inside of the arch, and this is the inside of the arch is 2,000 years old. The outside has been rebuilt, but the inside was 2,000 years old. And the inside, there was all these Jewish symbols on the inside. And I'm like temple symbols, like the menorah, like the altar. And I'm thinking, what on earth? So I asked our guide, what's the purpose? This is to commemorate the Roman victory over the Jewish revolt in the first century AD. So I got to kind of see it from both sides. You know, throughout Israel, they'll talk about the Jews being defeated by the Romans in the first century. And in Rome, they have something there to memorialize the fact that they defeated the Jews. So it's kind of a full circle moment there. Anyway, you get that free of charge. But, so, let's talk about the Sicarii. The Sicarii were the last remnants of the Jewish rebels, okay? And they made what had formerly been Herod the Great's palaces their stronghold. And the Romans brought 8,000 soldiers against Masada and the Sicarii to lay siege. What does it mean to lay siege? I mean, you surround and you don't let anything in or out. Okay? Over time, when they don't have access to food, they don't have access to water, we'll talk about water in a minute, the goal of any siege is to get them to come out, right? So they laid siege to the city, or to Masada, to the palace. Now, what happens next depends on which story you believe, okay? Because there's two different stories. One story, which was what was written by Josephus, is that, yes, all the Jews died except for, I think, eight. All the Jews on Masada died except for eight because they all killed themselves in a mass suicide. Okay, again, we'll talk more about that in a minute. That's what's written in what Josephus wrote. However, most archaeologists think that there's nothing to that story that makes any sense. And they would say, no, that's not what happened. That's a fairy tale that was written to give the Jews something to have pride in, that we weren't really defeated by the Romans. We defeated ourselves. We gave up, but they didn't defeat us. But the archaeologists will say all the evidence shows that Rome made it to the top of Masada and utterly wiped them out. Okay, believe what you want. Okay, it's been 2,000 years. I don't know exactly what happened up there. Believe what you want. But let me tell you, to the Jews, it's a big deal. How big of a deal is it? You ever heard how every Jewish or Israeli citizen has to serve in the military? I mean, that is as part of their citizenship, okay? The final ceremony when they go through their equivalent of basic training, when they join the Israeli army, the final ceremony, you know where it is? It's on top of Masada. Okay? It's a big deal. So, by the way, whatever story you believe, never tell a Jew that's not what happened, okay? Because you're not going to get very far if you try to have that conversation. Okay? I'm telling you, FYI, there's two sides, all right? Believe whichever one you want, okay? But that's what Josephus said happened. Now, we'll talk more about the suicide as we go through this. All right. This is from the level of the desert, the Judean wilderness, this is Masada. Okay, again, it's a mountain with a flat top. It's a mesa. Okay, so what can we see from this picture? Well, one, you can see the size of Masada, again, 1,500 feet tall. Ignore the visitor center down here in the bottom. You have to have some logistical stuff for people to be able to get up on top these days. Okay, but what I want you to notice, you notice this little zigzag going up. Can everybody see that? That little zigzag going up to the top of that? That trail goes all the way back to when this was built. It is called the Snake Trail, and that is the road for how you access the top of Masada, okay? It is today a hiking trail. I had never been there when I had enough time to do it. It is a bucket list for me. I want to climb the snake path, okay? And then I'm going to go buy a t-shirt in the gift shop that says, I hiked Masada, okay? That's a bucket list for me. Matter of fact, the trip that several of us were going to go on, they got canceled. What reason was that one canceled? That was the Gaza. Yeah. I had already told the company that was organizing it, I want enough time in Masada that I can climb the snake path. Don't tell me we only got an hour. I'm climbing the snake path. Of course, that trip never happened, so that's all moot. But that's what that is. That's the snake path. That is not how most people access it today. Most people get there through a gigantic gondola, like a ski lift, okay, that goes up to the top. But that's the original path that goes up to the top. From the top, I just want to show you this as an FYI. This is the Judean wilderness. This is the Judean wilderness. You can see the Dead Sea in the background. But when you read about John the Baptist was in the wilderness, this is the Judean wilderness. When you read about Jesus went out into the wilderness to be tempted, this is the wilderness. This is what it looks like. Okay, it's not completely devoid of hills, but it just so happens I'm standing on the biggest hill taking a picture. So what I'm taking a picture of looks completely flat. Okay, but there are some hills. There's a lot of hills in the Judean wilderness. But leading up to the Dead Sea, this is all pretty flat. Okay, now, around the outside, at desert level, there's all these squares. Okay, these are excavations of the Roman encampment from when the 8,000 soldiers besieged Masada and surrounded it. Okay. This is the archaeological evidence that the siege did happen, that the Romans did lay siege to Masada. And they are, this is one, how many would you say there were, Kate? 50 everywhere around Masada. As you walk around the outside of the top, they're all over the place. Now, getting up to the top, if you climb the snake path, this is where it comes out. This is the snake gate, okay? And you'll notice through the gate that there's this wall. And this wall surrounded the top of Masada. So if you think back to the flat top mountain, that entire flat top was surrounded by a casement wall. What is a casement wall? It's a wall that has like rooms in it. Okay, so it's thick, and you notice it has doors in it. So they would actually use these to store things. And this would also be where they put some of their fighting stuff, you know, to take on attackers that are coming. These are casement walls, okay? But this is, again, one of the outer casement walls. This is the snake gate at the top of the snake path. This is 4 years ago, so Sarah was a little shorter then. But just to show you some of the building techniques. This is inside a commander's house. Some of the artifacts that have been found inside this house identify this as being a commander's house. Someone who was, again, in charge of Roman troops in Herod the Great's palace. This is in the Northern Palace complex. And I put this in here to show, again, building technique. This looks like a solid column, like you would see in a Roman city, like a marble column. However, I think all this is built out of limestone. And the way it's built, the way these columns were built, was they would take all the rocks and they would cut them in circles like pancakes, and they would stack them on top of each other, and then they would cover the outside with plaster to make them look like they were one piece. Okay? So what is really inside of this is a whole bunch of skinny, flat pancake rocks that they stacked on top of each other. Okay? Now, as we go along, this is inside that same commander's house. You notice some of the paint is still on the walls from 2,000 years ago. This palace was not just all tan in color. Inside, there were rooms that were painted with different colors. Now, the black line that you see there is what they refer to as a restoration line. If any of you get the chance to go to Israel or anywhere where they have lots of archaeology, you will probably see something similar to this. Everything below that line has not been touched. Everything above that line, they have attempted to take what they have found around it and put it back together like a jigsaw puzzle. Okay, so I have very mixed feelings about it, but it is what it is. It just is what it is. Okay, in one sense, I'll enumerate. In one sense, you get a better idea of what it actually looked like, and they're using original materials mostly. Okay. On the other side, you're like, how do you know that's exactly how it fit together? You know, so there's trade-offs, okay? But what's below the line? The painted wall, so again, this is limestone rock covered in plaster that's painted. And the paint is still there 2,000 years later. It's crazy, isn't it? Again, what they were able to build, how much power did this man have, and what kind of a construction crew did he have to be able to build this up on top of a 1,500 foot tall mesa, okay? This is one of the quarries up on top of Masada where they got the rock from. So I think the technical term is something like didymite, but didymite is partially limestone and partially something else. I am not a geologist, okay? Just like I said, I'm not what did I say this morning? Psychologist? I'm also not a geologist, but I've memorized the names. That's something, right? But this is where one of the places where they dug the rocks. Why did they quarry from here to build this? Because it's way up on top of this mesa, okay? If you're bringing it in from the outside, by the way, when we look at Caesarea Maritima, though, Caesarea Maritima was built out of materials that do not exist in Israel. It's not even a matter they don't exist in Caesarea. They don't exist in Israel. So, again, how much power did this man have? He had a lot of power. But this is an example of one of the quarries. This is a kind of large, just to kind of give you a sense of the size of this palace. This is just the Northern Palace. The remnants of the walls of a part of the Northern Palace. I keep adding modifier. Is it really already 10 minutes to 7? Oh, wow. Okay. All right, let's move on. This is an example of a storage house inside the temple. Holes in the bottom of the storage house to store barley, grain.
On the outside, you can see a jar, a two-handled jar that would be used for wine. Moving on, this is the most amazing thing about the construction of Masada. This is the palace's terraces, and there's three terraces. Okay, now where I'm at when I'm taking this picture is I am standing on top of the topmost terrace, looking down onto the middle terrace, and then there's one below. Do you know where these are built? These are built on the side of the mesa. Okay, this is a model of what they would have looked like when they were pristine. Okay, it's on literally on the corner of the mesa. He built, had these terraces built, you know, it's like his back porch for his palace built down the side of this mountain, okay? And from here, you can see pieces of what is left from those terraces on those three different levels on the side of this mesa. Again, this was built 2,000 years ago. Now, also throughout the mountain itself, you see all these holes. These are man-made holes in this mountain, okay? And connecting the holes together are these channels. Anybody have a guess what that's for? Water. Yes, it actually does rain. Not a lot, not much at all around the Dead Sea, but it does rain a little. And this is for catching water. The entire outside of the mesa that where Masada is built has these channels for catching rainwater. The channels connect these holes. The holes are tunnels that go to cisterns that were inside the mountain. So they could store water for a long time. Okay? So yes, they had their own way of getting to water, even in the middle of a desert where it only rains like 1/10 of 1 inch a year. Okay? Crazy. This was Herod the Great's bathhouse. Okay, I don't know if you've ever been in a modern day sauna. You may know a lot of saunas will have a sauna and they'll have a cold room. You know, you go to the cold room, then you go to the sauna, and then you go to the cold room to close the pores back up. Well, Herod's bathhouse had a cold room, a cool room, and a hot room. Okay, so three different places for three different temperatures for relaxing, bathing. I mentioned that over time that this facility was occupied by different people. This right here is a baptistry. A baptistry from the Byzantine period. So after the Sicarii were all killed, sometime in the next century, the Byzantines started coming in and turned some of this into religious facilities, if you will, including a baptistry that is now in the middle of Herod the Great's bathhouse. Okay, now this is I put this in there kind of for comedic effect, but this is an archway that connects this would be the cool room to the hot room, and I wonder if this gives us any indication of how tall Herod the Great was. Kate had to kneel down to get through it. I don't know. But this is connecting those two sides together. And the hot room, let me explain quickly how this works. And it's probably the last thing that I cover tonight. I don't remember how many slides I have left. But on the outside, you can see a hole right here that they put a little piece of yellow plastic over it to make it look like fire. Because in the time of Herod, there would have been a fire burning on this exterior hole. But through this hole would come water, okay? And water, heated water, would fill the floor. The floor was raised. You see the remains of the floor here, they were held up by these little pylons, okay? So there's a cavity underneath the floor that would be filled with hot, hot water. In the walls were pipes. What would go through the pipes? The steam from the water. 1st century BC steam room, okay, for Herod the Great, okay. I talked about those cisterns. This is one of those cisterns that you know, they dug down to find the cistern where that water would be collected. I think there were 25 cisterns inside the mesa that Herod the Great had built. This is the remains of a Jewish synagogue. A building in the northern palace that was converted to a Jewish synagogue during the time of the Jewish revolt. This is where Josephus said that the mass suicide took place. The way he said it took place was that there was a rabbi named Ben Yair. I'm doing better with the memory thing. A rabbi named Ben Yair, okay, and he had all the people, I think there were a few hundred, to cast lots. We talked about casting lots before. Casting lots, and the lot fell on 10. Of those 10, the 10, their responsibility was to execute everybody, all the members that were there, the Sicarii, and then commit suicide. And the question would be, well, then, if that all happened, how do we know about it? Again, as Josephus tells it, there were 5 women and I think 3 children. Don't quote me on that. Go look it up on Wikipedia. I don't remember exactly, but 5 women, a few children, I think 3, that hid in a cistern and overheard Ben Yair telling all of this and heard it all happen, but through the cistern and through the tunnel, they escaped the Romans and they lived to tell the tale. Again, believe what you want to believe, okay? Believe what you want to believe. I've had 2 guides over there, one that told me it happened one way and one that told me it happened another way. One who was a Coptic Christian and one who was a Jew. And so, again, I believe whatever story you want to believe. All right. But this is where Josephus said that happened. Again, you can see these columns, which are made the same way, limestone, pancakes stacked together. I think I got 2 more things on here. This is the case, part of the casement wall. This part of the casement wall, though, is referred to as the casement of the scroll for this reason. If you were to look up right now on the internet, where were the Dead Sea Scrolls found? You would probably find the first answer would be Qumran. Okay, Qumran is just north of Masada. Most of what we call the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in Qumran, but not all of them. What the Dead Sea Scrolls were is another lesson for another day. Okay, very important discovery, archaeological discovery, in very recent history, by the way, compared to this. But not all Dead Sea Scrolls were found in Qumran. A few were found inside these casement walls. Not sure how they got there. We have a better explanation of how they ended up in Qumran. Don't have any plans to do a Qumran lesson anytime soon, but if you have questions about that, I can tell you what I know. Don't know exactly how they ended up in here, other than, again, a lot of different people occupied this and moved in and moved out. But one of the scrolls that they found is the story in Ezekiel of the Valley of the Dry Bones. I think that's Ezekiel 37. Somebody check me on that. That was found in these casement walls, which is why it's known as the casement of the scroll. Okay, this is the last slide. Okay, so we are going to finish. This is the last slide. This is at the edge of the casement wall, looking straight down to the bottom of Masada. Okay, so what are you looking at? What you're looking at is the ramp that the Romans built to pierce the wall and finally defeat the Jews who were encamped upon Masada. And so 2,000 years later, it's still there. It doesn't quite reach all the way to the top anymore. I'm sure erosion, the wind, there's a lot of wind. But I think, does everybody see how that works? Can everybody tell what you're looking at? It's a big ramp. Like I'm standing on top of the wall and the troops would have been coming up that ramp right at me. Okay? That's how the Romans finally defeated the last stronghold of the Jews in the great Jewish-Roman revolt. Okay? That's still there. So, again, you know, why do we cover this? Just so you get a sense of what, you know, how much power Herod the Great had. That he could build something like this in the middle of the Judean wilderness on top of a 1,500-foot tall mesa. And not just build a little shack up on top of it, build these ornate terraces hanging off the side of it. This man had power and he had the backing of Rome. He was the Roman appointed king of Judea. That is the climate in which Jesus was born. That is why, you know, Joseph and Mary were told, take him to Egypt until this man dies. He's got a lot of power. He's got a lot of power. Lord willing, next time we'll look at Herodium, which is even more unbelievable than this, as far as a building project goes. So, Again, trying to give context to the world in which Jesus was born, the world in which he ministered, the world in which he died, the world in which his early disciples took the gospel out and spread it among the world. Why? Because what happened in the gospel is real, and it's surrounded by what is real. Okay? Herod the Great, real person who did real things, and who the evidence of him is still there 2,000 years later because he was real. And so all of this is reality. And part of faith is for, you know, is this becoming real? You know, we didn't witness any of it, right? So it has to become real to us. It has to become real to us so that we can make the decision to put our life on Christ. It has to be real. If you're ready to make the commitment to Christ, why not begin that tonight? If there's anything else we can do for you, please come while Donnie leads us in our invitation song.